Welcome to the Human Tapestry Podcast, the podcast where we explore the rich tapestry of humanity through conversations about gender, sexuality, relationships, and sexual practices. You may have noticed that there wasn't an episode last week. Unfortunately, since this is a labor of love and not a labor of income, my day job took precedence, so I wasn't able to get this out until now. The good news, though, is that we have several episodes coming up with conversations with old friends and new. Now, this week, I'm talking with Peter, who you heard in episode 7 about 3 weeks ago. We caught up on the last 4 years and talked more about his journey, as well as balancing relationships in this time of quarantine, different forms of intimacy, his amazing work teaching students how to teach sexuality, intimacy, and relationships, and a bunch of other topics. Now, after the recorded interview, Peter and I actually had a deeper conversation about this podcast, and I realized just how much I've learned during the process of putting it together. He challenged me to start writing my thoughts and what I've learned from each episode, and I plan to start with this one, so watch the Human Tapestry feeds for some deep thoughts. And Peter may be coming back later on just to actually have a conversation with me about what I've learned, so listen for that in the coming couple of months. So now, let's get to the conversation. So, it's been 4 years since we've talked over, well, not even Zoom. I think we've talked over Zoom, but talked in a recorded atmosphere, I guess. So,
yep.
I've had conversations on husbands out to wives and stuff, but and I know that a lot has changed for you since we last talked, as far as, you know, at that point we last talked, you had a boyfriend, but you were just trying to kind of figure out what was going on with that. So I guess to start, just kind of catch us up on what's happened in your life since then.
Yeah. So, I'm no longer with that boyfriend. That relationship's over time came to an end. And there was a period of me like being depressed, thinking I'll never meet anybody. But then I did. And now I've been in another relationship for over a year and a half that seems potentially forever. And it's significantly a different kind of feeling from the last one. Like I feel like maybe that last one was still a kind of relationship that people might have in their adolescence or late adolescence as a trial relationship that really doesn't seem to work before they really do meet the right person. And my whole gay life started in my 50s. So that now I'm 60, going to be 61. And, you know, 10 years later, like if I had had those first explorations in my early teens, you know, I'd be in my late 20s finding someone that I could potentially think I could spend my life with, but I'm 61. So, and I'm still married to my wife, who I met about 40 years ago. And there's ongoing tension and confusion about how those two things work together. And that hasn't really been resolved any more than the last time we spoke, I guess. Mm.
So you're still trying to work out how that's going to ultimately look for you too? Is that?
Yeah, and also with my boyfriend as well, who would like to move toward a committed, exclusive relationship. So it's not really sustainable in either direction. And it's tough to balance the two relationships.
Sure.
Because two relationships are not two half relationships. They're two full relationships. And each person, you know, would like to be the most important person in my life. And they don't interact with each other more than minimally, just in a polite way. Mm-hmm. So that's the dominant anxiety, I guess, is it's not really sustainable for me completely. And I'm not really good at doing two relationships at once. Although, you know, I have a therapist, and weekly she will say things like, it does seem to be working for you since, you know, you're still with both of them and they're both with you.
Yeah.
That's.
Yeah, I was going to say, there seems to be something. At least between, like, because, yeah, you've been in the relationship with your wife for 40 years and the one with your boyfriend for a year and a half or so. And so there's something there. You've got the two relationships going at least, but maybe more comfort in them is needed, I guess. I don't know. I'm not your therapist, so I'm not trying to.
But this is the kind of thing that someone like me ends up having to work through for themselves.
Sure.
And you know, and yeah, we're both members of the Husbands Out to Wives group, and I don't know if you participate in a group like GAMMA, the Gay Married Men's groups, you know, around the country. I haven't been very active in those groups lately because of the times of their meetings. But, you know, I also know a number of men through those groups. And in Philadelphia, there's also another social group called M5 on Meetup, which is really helpful for a lot of guys. I mean, like most men, like, you know, move toward clearly deciding for themselves that their wife is the most important commitment. And so they might have some kind of open relationship where they have sexual intimacy of some kind with a man or men in some way. And there's many options that people come to, you know. Or, you know, they decide that they need to be fully themselves as a gay man. They divorce or separate and live a life as a gay man that's either in a relationship with a man or, you know, pursuing a single gay life. Some kind. And then there's people like me who are sometimes held in small versions of pity or perhaps by these other men for not being able to decide. Right? That's how I see it. That's how I experience it.
Now, when you say not being able to decide, do you mean about your own attractions, or are you talking about with your relationship itself?
No, like needs, like life needs, relationship needs. We were talking before you started recording about the fact that I teach at a university and I teach a course about gender and sexuality education. Well, one of the themes in that course, you know, here I am, like I use my life as an example of someone that was messed up by our society's approaches to that. I'm pretty functional in the world, but I have a thread in that course where I ask students to consider that any intentional educational program should replace sex education or gender and sexuality with forms of education around intimacy and relationships. Like intimacy education, relationship education. And I suppose that's a reflection of my own concerns in my life, where I can't figure out my own relationship needs. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I can. I mean, this is what I need, what I'm providing for making happen for myself, I suppose. But it's rather complicated given. I did look, as we were also discussing before you started recording, there was that previous interview 4 years ago, and I did look over the first 10, 15 minutes of it, and in that part of that interview, I did bring up the societal condemnation of anything but monogamy and exclusive monogamy, and so, like, you know, I carry that own expectation for relationships into my life as well. I mean, I've been taught by, I don't know whether it's enculturation or acculturation or some forms of social education, you know, in the various educational institutions of my life, you know, family, school, media, you know, religious institutions, you know, that, you know, one person is what I should have. And the people I'm involved in my life with mostly wish that that were the case for me as well. And I don't know, I'm lucky in that I apparently am wonderful enough to these two people that they are, at least for now, are accepting this, at least in their minds temporarily, if not permanently.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny how, you know, we're taught from a young age, like, this is what intimacy should be. And this is how you should do it. And if you're not doing it in this way, you're wrong or abnormal or weird or whatever. Because if you're not with a woman in a, at a minimum, serial monogamous setup, then, you know, that's just kinky, weird, not right. Same thing with the relationships. You should have one person who meets all of your physical, emotional stability, everything needs in that one person for the rest of your life, period. And that doesn't work for a lot of us. So I don't know. I think it's good that you're teaching that in your courses, though.
Yeah, I have. I found in a resource, you know, that I use, an intimacy inventory kind of. It's a chart that I ask students to fill out, you know, and I do it for myself. And it kind of asks you where or who provide, where do you get or who provides the various forms of intimacy for you? How important do you think they are for you personally? You know, and things like that. And there are different kinds of intimacy. Like there's, you know, there's sexual, physical intimacy. That's one version of intimacy. There's also the idea of like shared experiences that you have together, you know, and then there's things like what's called work there, which are like everyday tasks, like that you, some people get in a work environment, like the ongoing tasks that need to be completed and you do them together. Also at home, like the work is like doing the dishes, cleaning the house, vacuuming, walking the dog, taking care of children. You know, that this builds a relationship and an intimacy between the two people that might be caretakers of the children, say, you know, like, and that's like the chart has like a whole bunch of different categories like this, you know,
I like that.
I can share it with you. It's really powerful. So like for me, you know, my wife provides like, you know, all of, you know, so many of them, you know, but not the physical intimacy right now. I mean, yes, we do have physical intimacy of a kind, you know, but, you know, my boyfriend is all, you know, off the charts on that and a bunch of other, you know, forms. And then there are things that neither of them provide, you know, and then it was interesting to me and my students last year, a number of them in my class put down themselves, I get this from myself. I don't need another person for this intimacy. I provide this to myself. And I thought, wow, you know, I'm not good at that. I don't provide anything for myself. They seem so, I don't know, grown up and mature compared to me. I talked to them about that. They laughed.
Well, sometimes they get like a lot of them probably come from a background that's not as restrictive and dogmatic about some of this as we were maybe raised in. But I'm really interested in that.
I really think most of them come from a background where it's far more restrictive, you know?
And they're pushing away from that.
Yeah, and where they are expected that they shouldn't look to anybody else for a lot of things as well. And so they've had to develop those kinds of skills, like self-reliance skills, maybe. I don't know. But yeah. But like, so I do think like the intimacy perspective is pretty interesting. Because when we talk about like sexuality and sexual configurations, like what, and how that fits with your own sense of your own identity, sexually and gender identity and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It sort of misses a lot of the point, which is that, you know, the ways that we are with others is pretty important, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it doesn't help me resolve any anxieties in my life, though.
Well, that's, you know, therapists help with that, I guess. But, yeah, I mean, and, yeah, because I get that because, you know, in my own journey, there's a lot of, why am I so weird, you know, and the internalized homophobia, the internalized kink shaming, you know, the internalized non-monogamy is wrong, things I learned over the years as a, you know, growing up, not even from my own family, just being around people that promote that. Like, it's so easy to just be like, I guess it just becomes so much a part of you that even though you, this is how it is for me, like my brain knows this is fine and it's doesn't devalue me as a person, but there's that little voice that comes up that's like, you know, it feels like it's not normal because people have said that. And I don't know, it's really funny though, because you teach this to people, so it seems like you probably have a, can give all the reasons and the,
well, it, yeah, I mean, I have a different kind of life experience from you, I think, in that I really can't, and I think I'm repeating something from 4 years ago, I can't think of times where I was explicitly kind of taught by my life that things were wrong. Yeah, I just was never exposed to the possibilities and never saw any like examples or images of these kinds of options. And so like, it never entered my mind. There's different kinds of ignorance. You know, this is something else that I think about given my profession, you know, as a professor of education, educational theorist. Like, ignorance goes along with knowing and learning, right? And we're kind of, we have to like gain forms of ignorance in order to learn and that kind of thing. And there's different kinds of ignorance. Like, it wasn't like some, well, maybe people like explicitly kept things from me, you know, because they didn't want me to know, like a kind of intentional ignorance from some powers that be. I don't know. I never like was explicitly taught that certain kinds of sexuality were wrong. I just never knew there were such forms of sexuality. Mm. You know?
Like, yeah.
And literally never, it never came to my mind because there was no, I don't know, like a lot of men, like early in their life, some like were exposed to something, you know, by an older person or a cousin or a friend or something. And I never had that happen. And I did have experiences that I could, or like ways of like understanding myself as different that may not have been like, you know, like a lot of gay men experienced themselves as different from others early in their life, let's say. And I had other ways to understand that, you know, like being one of the few working class people in an affluent suburb, being so that, you know, my parents were very different from other parents. Our home was very different. We were also like genetically Jewish and I suppose culturally Jewish, and there were very few Jews in that town. These were things that I understood as why people like thought I was different. I don't know if I'm retelling a story that was in the last video, but I've been thinking over the years obsessively about this kind of event in my life. I had a very good friend, possibly a best friend, named Jim, who you know, told me one day, you know, while we were playing with cars, you know, making roads in dirt and building like cities and like tunnels and things, that he had chosen the name Peter for his confirmation, and because it was, you know, okay, an important saint, but also the name of a very good friend. Mm. And that it would be so great when I was at his confirmation for me to hear that he was choosing this name for himself. And I was excited by this. I was like, wow, I really have a good friend. You know, having moved around a lot in the years before that, it made me feel good about, I've made friends, and it's hard to make friends when I move to a new place, and this is really a best friend. But then within a week, I was told that he was told that he could no longer play with me, and we're no longer going to see each other. That his family and his older brother told him that he had to like stop playing after school with me and go out for sports and do more things that boys do when they get to be older and start to think about going into high school and thinking about developing extracurricular activities that would be good for going to college. And so we were no longer friends, basically. And at the time, I was like, I just assumed it was because I was Jewish and they didn't want me at his confirmation, and they were kind of concerned that this was, that he wasn't doing enough boy things. And like his older brother was an athlete and very good at sports in high school, and he hadn't been doing that. And I just sort of took that as like this, a way in which people were like not wanting to be a sissy, but that was stupid, you know? And boy, I was really sad for him that he couldn't have a good time after school. But looking back, I'm like really wondering what else he had shared with his parents about his friendship and how important I was in his life. And I wonder, I wish I could find him. I've tried to search out what his life is like now. He's not on Facebook as far as I can tell under that name. I don't know where to find him, you know, like, but I wonder if he's gay, you know, and like they were worried too. And, you know, maybe I am too, you know, but they, if they had like, maybe we would have found that out together. I don't, you know, all these kinds of things. You know.
Sure.
But at the time, I assumed it was like while we weren't doing sports, and I was a music kid who wasn't going to do sports, and I was Jewish, and these were all the reasons why I shouldn't be at his confirmation. You know, like not that like they were worried that we were doing gay things or something.
Who knows?
You know, like things like, so that's like a sort of emblematic. I have several stories like that that I sort of unearthed by thinking back to my childhood, you know, about like these could have been times that I might have discovered something about my sexuality or my, you know, my own body or something, you know, and they didn't happen.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, and because I've heard it called just being other. You know, and that's, you know, the identity. That's why, like, you know, a lot of times this nice little chart of, you know, gay, cis, you know, all these different things don't really, because everything plays together, everything intersects. Like, there are a million reasons your friend could have left you, and they're all part of who you are as a person. And yeah, it'd be interesting to see where he came out in all this. So you didn't really even communicate with him after that then, huh?
No, we were certainly cordial and friendly in school when we saw each other, but we weren't really even in the same classes in school. Like, but yeah, this was like junior high. And then by the time high school was around, I don't know, like, yeah, we weren't in comparable classes. Like that's another, I could explain that by other things that sort of irrelevant to our conversation, I think.
Sure.
Yeah, but like, you know, like I was in these accelerated science and math classes. He wasn't, you know. He was in the Spanish classes. I was in Latin classes, you know. I did music, which required you to be in certain tracks of courses in order to be available during the like band orchestra times. He didn't, you know, he did other things.
Could almost be even just his parents were telling him that he needed to prioritize certain things.
Yeah.
That
yeah. He was, a very good, he was like, oh, it's funny. I know these things about him because it was a small school and also because I had a connection with him. He did cross country in the fall and track in the spring, and he was very good at it, you know, and it helped him get into college just like they expected him to, you know. He went to a college, like in the affluent suburb I grew up in, there was a strong push for people to go to the most prestigious college they could go to. And I think he ended up at a college that was like, you know, like for someone that would have had slightly better grades and more impressive academics, but he was a good track star, you know, as well. He also excelled. Like, I remember, like, he got an award at the end of our senior year for his outstanding achievement in Spanish. You know, so he was, he was not Hispanic or Chicano or anything. You know, so, like, you know, he was, you know, he wasn't a terrible student. He was actually a good student. You know? But I was, like, you know, a nerdy, outstanding student. You
know? Yeah, the gift of the musical. Yeah. He was the, not even the jock, I don't know. Just
he was different. The well-rounded, perfect, waspy guy. But he wasn't waspy because he was Catholic. So who knows?
Yeah. Interesting.
He was a real good guy.
A good guy. It sounds like he was a nice guy too, like not not a dude as I've heard them called. So interesting. Yeah. Shoot. I made a note and I don't understand what it means.
Well, while you're looking at it, well, one thing I thought of is that, like, something that's going on for me is that I have been looking back into my childhood and growing up and trying to look for, like, the stories that resonate as important for who I am. Mm-hmm. And that is something that I think might be common to men who come out later in life or who are questioning their sexuality or their gender identity later in life, you know, and that kind of thing, like in their 40s, 50s, 60s. You know, or 70s or 80s, you know, that we're like, well, what was going on for me when other people were clearer about the need to act on certain important things about themselves? You know, like, so like that's, we spent a lot of time on this one silly story of a guy that was hardly important in the trajectory of my life, really. But I've obsessed about that particular kind of event, along with a few others, as kind of critical in trying to understand how they could have been experienced differently. And if they had, wow, gosh, my life would have been really different.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you have that too.
But oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you look back, you look back on who you were or things that happened or thoughts you were having or perceptions you had, and you're like, oh, that makes sense now. Given, you know, now that I understand who I am, it makes more sense why I would respond that way. So, yeah. I mean, I think, well, is that what you're talking about? Or?
Well, yeah. Well, so for me, it's all about a loss of opportunities to understand myself. Mm-hmm. Because, like, you know, someone else in like the Husbands Out to Wives group or another kind of support group like Gamma might tell a story about a friend who, suggested during a sleepover that they share their bed and things got a bit more physical. Instead, I had that friend, perhaps this is what could have happened, but instead the parents were worried that that's where it was going. And because of who knows what's going on with them, or the older brother, or whatever else was happening in their house, and made sure it didn't happen, at least with me, at least tried to stop it. Like, that could be what happened, you know, but a lot of people had this experience, and then they used that to think about themselves. Like, you know, my current boyfriend, his family would go to probably the New Jersey Shore, I guess it was, in the summers, like, you know, from Pennsylvania. And he would go out for walks in the morning and sit looking at the beach, and he would see men and wish they would come over and sit with him. Mm. And at one point, a guy did. And he basically said, can you take me with you and do stuff with me? I mean, and the guy was like, well, are you sure? Like, that's what you want? Like, asked him like dozens of times, like, are you really comfortable with me sitting on this bench with you? Like, you know, do you really want to come back to my place with me? You know, and he did. And he, and it affirmed for him that this is what he wanted, right? Mm. So at the age of like, I don't know if it was 10 or 12 or 13 or whatever, he knew he wanted this and he made it happen and it happened. Like, I was never on a bench where a man, if they did, I don't know, I guess I didn't say the right things. You know, instead, I like things didn't happen like that for me. You know, and I wonder why.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the other kind of story I tell is of this piano teacher I had who I now can think back to, wow, I was really like attracted to him, you know, at the age of like 16, 17. And I knew he was gay, but I didn't at that time understand my feelings as an attraction. I just thought it was about this guy thought I was talented at piano and he took an interest in me for that reason. I think that was at least part of it, if not most of it, you know, although I think he might have suspected I was gay. I don't know. But he also never did anything inappropriate. Like, he never touched me in a way that you might say an adult should not do. Whereas someone else might have been like, you know, my piano teacher. You know, he didn't take his hand off my hand when he was showing me how to hold my hand right. And then he reached up my arm and squeezed it. And I got chills up my spine. No, I mean, I just like going to him.
Right.
And he never did anything. I liked him sitting on the bench with me. You know? But if he had been, if he had done what would be considered statutory rape, it might have taught me something. Yeah. Gosh darn it, why didn't he do anything illegal?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's one of those things that back then when you're doing it, you don't really know why it's that way or even know that it's not something that's different because it's, you know, we all assume that our life experience is the norm. So, you know, until you look right, back on it with a different lens, then you're like, oh, so that's what I was, that's why that was happening.
So another story like that, which I probably said in my last interview too, but it's emblematic for me. You know, like I was very young for my grade in school. I was smaller anyway, you know, with a late September birthday and small. And I was kind of nerdy and a music kind of kid. So like in gym classes, like a lot of kids would like, you know, bully me a lot and just like knock me over and run me over on purpose. And in locker rooms, they would really tease me and bully me. And they'd be like, oh, do you want to look at my penis? You want to look at my dick, my cock, whatever, you know, oh, are you a fag, you know? And I mean, my reaction was always like, well, why are you afraid to admit you want me to? Why are you trying to get me to do it? Okay, I'll look at it for you. Well, I shared those kinds of stories with a therapist I used to go to, and Alan, that therapist, said, you know, like, straight guys don't do that. And I was like, really? I mean, like, they don't look. Like, they're not. And I'm like, I think they all look, and they're all comparing, but they're afraid to admit it because they don't want to be accused of being gay, even if they don't even have the desire to have someone stare at their cock. And he'd be like, no, Peter, like, gay guys look at cocks like that. I'm like, well, I saw you saying, like, this football-playing guy in my class say, like, was not wanting me to look. I think all straight guys are looking when they go to public restrooms. They're comparing constantly. They're worried they're inadequate, and they're afraid to admit it, you know. And that was the story I told myself all my life. But I didn't really think about the fact that, like, I was looking.
Yeah.
You know, and I think I was looking because it was hard for me not to. Like, I didn't want to look. I mean, you know. Mm-hmm. And that is a difference between me and some other people who would have just brushed it off as, what's wrong with you? You're probably gay. And I looked. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Something like that.
Yeah.
But I would call their bluff was what was my idea. Yeah. But, like, I don't know, like, there are scenes in movies where something like that happens, and it turns out, like, the really big, hulky football player is actually gay or at least gay curious and does want some kind of interaction, and it happens. That never happened for me, though.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really surprised at that, because like, it seems like such a binary blanket statement to say no straight guy would ever look. It's like, there are reasons a straight guy would look. There's reasons a straight guy wouldn't look. There's reasons a gay guy might not look. I mean, it's so, and you know, even just because you're not straight doesn't mean you're gay. It's, you know, there's just a whole variety. Yeah.
I brought up the story because like this idea that you know, you kind of think everyone's like you. Like, I always looked. And I always...
Yeah, you thought everybody looked. Yeah.
Yeah. And when they were, like, bullying me because... They weren't bullying me because I was looking. Like, I was carefully not looking because you weren't supposed to in the locker room. And I was busy trying to get dressed and trying to avoid getting bullied. Like, they might smash my head against the locker or something.
Right.
You know, like, they would trip me on the wet, slippery locker floor, you know, like, on purpose, you know, like... Because they could, and it was fun for them. Like, you know, and I was small and bullyable. And it wasn't like, I wasn't really like a victim of bullies like a lot of kids were. But I would regularly get that kind of attention because of, you know, because of my nerdiness and the music connection and not being an athlete and stuff. Like, it wasn't like, I was certainly not like the focus of that kind of activity, but it happened all the time. Because it would happen to anyone they could do it to, as often as they could do it. You know, and so I would be careful about trying to avoid being in that situation, not to bring it on. But it would happen certainly a couple of times a month. You know,
I'll say it's that Maslow, it's that Maslow's hierarchy. You know, self-preservation is going to go above wanting to admire a naked guy. So, you know, and then, I don't know. It's
we were in communal like showers before we were getting dressed at the locker. There was certainly plenty of opportunity to see enough bodies, you know, that you didn't need to stare at the locker as well, you know.
Right.
So,
yeah, it's interesting the way not only do we tend to put ourselves, like, project our own attitudes and stuff on other people, but then the measures we will go to, we humanity, not you and I necessarily, but the measures we'll go to cover up what we're actually feeling on the inside. You know, like, some of those guys may have actually had an attraction and they're just covering it up by bullying people
so that they
don't have to be.
So I know that, like, most men learn in, like, a lot of, at least American, communities, you know, North American communities, that when you go into a public restroom, you make sure not to stand next to someone else at a urinal.
Urinal rules, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know, the story, I would always tell myself, oh, okay, someone's here. They're going to be worried that I'll think they're trying to look at me, so for their comfort, I need to move at least a urinal away or further, as far away as possible. Whereas I suppose someone else might be like, I don't want them to think I'm trying to look. So I better go as far away as possible. But the story I always told myself was, they're afraid that I'm going to think they're looking, because of course they are, because all men look. Mm. And that was, you know, and that's again, like, you know, building on your idea that we think that other people are thinking like us. I mean, at the time, I didn't think about how I was thinking, but that was basically a projection of my own thinking, but I didn't realize it for decades, decades, you know.
Yeah. And once you understand who you actually are, it's much easier to see who you were being back then. So,
if I had understood that in my 20s, I might have been able to differentiate between people who wanted to look and didn't want to look. Mm-hmm. Or I could have decided whether I wanted to suggest it would be okay to look or not look. You know, like, by deciding where to stand or how to hold my body. None of which I learned, like other gay men might have learned in their teens or 20s, because I didn't know how to learn about my... It never happened for me. Mm-hmm. That's how I see it now.
Yeah. It's amazing. I want to drop way back in this conversation here real quick, because it's something you said that kind of got tickled me a little, because I know the I know this happens a lot for people that come to an understanding of themselves later in life. So you said your previous boyfriend who you had when we were first talking was like the type of relationship you'd have as an adolescent. And so, like, I mean, and I hear this a lot where once, if you don't understand who you are till, like I said, you know, the later years, you know, you're more into your adulthood. So in your 40s, 50s, or however long it is, it's almost like adolescence happens at that point. And obviously not physically, because, you know, biology, but there definitely does seem to be something to that where you just want to go try the things like you would have wanted to try when you were a teenager. I don't know what, if you've seen that or,
I mean. Oh, yeah. I mean, I went through that. I mean, yeah. Once I had a sense that I was interested in sex with men, I went through that crazy adolescent phase that a lot of guys coming out older in life go through, where I almost had an uncontrollable, like almost every day of the week, at least one person hooking up, and thinking, how do I know what I like or want or need unless I try it? Mm-hmm. I never did this with like drugs in my life. I was, you know, a really very limited experience with recreational drugs. I never really did this with alcohol. Yeah, I mean, I certainly drink and I still do, you know, but I have no, like, I never had like a out of control compulsion to do things like I did in that 3 or 4 month period when I first came out to myself and then the world, you know, like, you know, where I really explored. But then I kind of quickly, like, I was like a fast track adolescence. I mean, I quickly came to a later adolescence, kind of like, where I was interested in finding like a person I could have a relationship with. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what that needed to look like, but I went through like a couple of guys where I would see them every other week. We would like go on a kind of a date and spend the day or the day and the night together, kind of like what people do when they're dating and they think they're getting serious about someone. Yeah. And that was all I was really interested in at that time, you know. And then I kind of found someone, and I guess you could say we tried it out, and it eventually didn't work for me, I guess. Like, I finally came to the conclusion that it wasn't right. And then, you know, and then I, you know, I was still sort of looking for someone like that, that would be like a relationship. And I don't know, like some men who come out later in life who are married to women think, well, I've made this commitment to this woman, so thank goodness that they'll let me sort of have this like recreational time outside of my marriage, but I'm certainly not going to be emotionally connected to anyone. And I'll do some kind of safe version of sex, like where we, the person I have sex with, like I know that I'm not going to bring diseases home and that sort of thing. But somehow the people that are attracted to me and that I'm attracted to tend to be people who really want a pretty strong emotional connection. And it doesn't work. Like I can't even have sex with someone anymore unless, like, I won't get an erection, for example, unless it's like a real connection. I won't get an erection staring at someone, which was maybe part of the problem in my biological adolescence. Like, I would test myself sometimes. I wouldn't suddenly get an erection looking at a man. Of course, I wasn't looking at the right man because I'm never a teenager. Didn't work when I was in my 50s. Doesn't work when I'm 60. You know, but I don't know. Like, yeah, you really learn about yourself and what your needs are. I mean, early on, though, I could get an erection with almost any man because I wanted the excitement of trying this new thing, or like with a group of men, you know, or like, you know, I don't know, you know, it was so arousing.
Yep.
I don't know. I don't think that would happen for me anymore because I don't put myself in those situations.
Right. Well, you're finding what's what's your thing. And we change over time, too, with what works for us and what doesn't, you know, I think. So.
And then, like, if you can find someone who really is, like, really satisfying your physical desires, you don't really have any kind of, like, need to seek anything outside of that. Mm-hmm. Right. That's so, true. Well, in my current situation is like that. Mm-hmm. I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. So, are you, cause I know last time you were kind of had an apartment and your house, if I remember right, is it similar to that? Or, I mean, I guess with quarantine, yes. It's probably changed a lot, but.
Well, I mean, you know, so I met my boyfriend, y'all, you know, like, well, yeah, more than a year before the pandemic, right? Very conveniently, he lives like 5 minutes away from my home. Like the apartment was in the center of the city, and I live kind of on an outer part of a neighborhood. You know, so with that boyfriend, you know, it was like a 20-minute drive or train ride, and it was a complicated like arrangement. Like I have a dog that I'm. The primary caretaker for. So bringing the dog into the city, you can't take the dog on the train, you have to drive in. So it's always logistically complicated and all that. So in the current situation, it's like outrageously convenient. Like I could walk to his house or I could drive there in 5 minutes. You know, the walk would be more like 20, I guess. So he has a house and he has a room, housemate. You know, and it's a really nice house. Yeah, it's more comfortable than mine in the summer. It's got central air conditioning. And the one like glitch in the convenience is that he's still, after more than almost 2 years now, still concerned about my dog and his cats. You know, the cats are anxious about the dog. He's afraid that the cats, I don't know, might get traumatized. So. We always have to like sort of like, be careful about the dog. But I bring the dog there. He loves the dog. Like I don't know if you heard a little like ringtone before when we first started talking. That was him texting me about planning that maybe tomorrow like we could go to the park with the dog before we get together. You know, like he wants to see more of the dog. Yeah. but this is the situation. Like he has a house and we mainly meet there. I mean, so before the pandemic, my wife works a commute away from home. It's like an hour and 15 minutes. And there was commonly situations where she would need to be at work in the evening and then early the next day. And so she would often spend one or two nights at a friend or, you know, at a friend's home near her work, a colleague's home, you know, like, and so my boyfriend would sometimes spend time at my house during those days, you know, and we also have done a few times, we've taken trips where we've gone away for a weekend, say, you know, so I've gone with him for a few nights, say a couple of nights. And there was also like back in January, we visited his brother and sister-in-law in Florida. So we went for a week to Florida together, you know. So that's how we're together. Like I will spend like three or four nights a week at his house. You know, I'll go over for dinner and then spend the night into the next morning. We might go out for breakfast or something, you know. Or I'll go over after dinner. He doesn't want to inconvenience his housemate too much. And his housemate's not always so comfortable with this other love interest around. So, you know, like his housemate will go upstairs to his bedroom and, you know, I'll come over by the time he's about to do that. I don't need to avoid his housemate, you know, but it just seems to help with their house.
Sure, sure.
Oh. And that's kind of the situation.
Sounds like you have it pretty well worked out for now.
Yeah. Last night we had a lovely date. We went and had an outdoor dinner at a very nice restaurant. He took me out to a very fancy restaurant for dinner.
Nice.
Then we went back to his house. And, you know, I had to leave very early in the morning because of my dog, who was at home, so I could go take the dog. And the dog wasn't left alone at home. His dog was with my wife, but I'm really the dog person in the family. You know, so, like, she'll let the dog out to pee or something, but I need to take the dog for a walk in the morning. So I had to leave, you know, pretty early.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the arrangement. If he didn't want more than that, that could be forever, right? But he wants more, and my wife is okay with 3 nights a week. More than that, she starts to think we're more like housemates and roommates rather than husband and wife. So for special events, you know, I'll arrange that I'll be out, you know, with him for an extra night, say, which is increasingly, it's become more often than she would like. That's one of the tensions, you know.
Sure.
My boyfriend is really big into anniversaries. Like, the 9th of the month is the anniversary of our first date. Mm. So it would be good if we spent every 9th of every month together.
Sure.
It's very romantic.
Yeah, that is neat. Well, I will say from my perspective, talking to you now and thinking back to the first time we talked, it sounds like you're still, I mean, that's the fun part about relationships, is they're always going to have things you need to work on and figure out and get to, but it feels like you have a much more positive look on it.
Does it?
Yeah, it does. It actually does.
The moral of the story is just, you know, just gets better. That mantra that goes on now.
Not always, but I think in this case it has. Like, sometimes it just takes time and learning. I don't know. Learning yourself helps you be better to other people too. You know.
I mean, I do think, like, going back to that idea that people go through an adolescence at a point in which they really do figure out a lot of things about themselves. I'm gathering that people in their teens and 20s often go through, like, a relationship that lasts, like, say, 3 years or a year or whatever. And you know, they're upset when it falls apart. But looking back on it, you know, as time goes on, they're like, you know, that helped me learn what I need from someone, or what I can't give, or what I need to give. And, like, so, like, that relationship I had when we were talking last time, I mean, the two of us wanted a relationship. And, you know, it was very volatile, very explosive. Like, we would, but that could be felt as like intense feelings. Like, it could be misread as like a romance, you know. And then when we would make up, the passion would be intense, you know. But you know, a lot of the, like, problems came from, I want to say, him, you know, or his, you know, the fact that he was not right for me,
yeah,
you know, or I wasn't right for him. But, like, he also, I really believe, you know, it's like, you know, I had a lot of, like mental health issues. Let me just put it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, the guy I'm with now, like, it just feels really different. And I was like, this is someone I belong with more than that kind of other person.
Right.
Like, I can't believe, it's like, how did this happen? That we could find each other.
That sometimes just happens. And it's something that just happens when it happens, I think. So, speaking of learning about yourself and about sexuality, you said earlier you teach gender and sexuality. Gender and sexuality courses. And yeah. Go ahead.
No, I do.
And I'm just, well, I know we had talked earlier, and I really want you to get a chance to kind of talk about the podcast and the YouTube channel that you're sharing with your students. But I want to, like, how is that helping you teaching that, talking to your students about this? getting their perspectives as you have conversations and doing the curriculum for it. Is it helping you to understand yourself and your relationships and the way you interact with them better? Or is it just, because I also know there's also the, I can tell you all about this stuff and then apply it to myself sometimes is not as easy, but I don't know, does it help or is it, or what has it done for you, I guess?
I don't know. I do think it's important to, that this kind of a course be available. Mm-hmm. I don't know, you know, but I don't know if it's help, if it helps me directly. I'm trying to think about it. You know, I mean, I was, you know, always interested and committed to gender and sexuality kinds of issues throughout my life, which makes it more amazing to me that I couldn't figure out things about myself, but maybe that was how I was negotiating that at the time, right? Like there was this movement when I was in college. Someone started these men's groups. And they were like feminist discussion groups for men. And I joined one. I was like, oh, I want to do that because it seemed like the cool thing to do. You know? Where we would discuss how we could be feminists. You know, yeah, I, like, you know, like at that time, so this is like late 70s, early 80s, like, you know, there were like Take Back the Night marches on campus, and we wouldn't organize them. We would participate in a supportive way, you know, because a feminist wouldn't, you know, a man wouldn't take over the event for women that was empowering all the, you know, like, but we would have, we would meet weekly, you know. I was always concerned about the pronouns I used in my writing, you know. At the time, I would use he or she and not just he as the grammatically correct thing. Over time, I grew to learn that that was still problematic, you know, and on and on and on. And in graduate school, one of my special areas in graduate school was critical feminist studies, you know, which I just thought was really cool, you know. And also, I believed that how can someone not be reading and studying this stuff, because it's something that would, that was like the most recent things that you could use to think about social theory and so on, you know. I was actually a graduate student fellow at the Institute for the Humanities at the University of Michigan. When I was writing my dissertation, I applied and I was selected. It was extremely a powerful honor. Like there were two or three of us chosen from, I don't know how many, more than 100 applicants, you know, graduate students at the university to be fellows for the year. And the theme was histories of sexualities, you know, and I made my dissertation on professional discourses about mathematics education and diversity education be relevant to histories of sexualities in the application. And I spent, you know, and really informed my academic thinking, you know, to be participating in this year that went on for the whole year, you know, with all the like most cutting edge scholars of gender and sexuality studies, you know, coming to the university for residences for a week or more and seminars, you know. When my first job, I was an affiliated member of the Women's Studies Department. I taught a course on gender and technology, gender science and technology. Then when I came to my current, you know, position, I wanted to teach courses like that, but like I wasn't seen as being hired to do that in the beginning. It took a while to negotiate into that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. you know. And, you know, when I was coming out to myself, figuring out things and then to the world, I had this conversation with a good professional friend who teaches in Rhode Island now, you know, and she was like, well, you have to teach about this, Peter. Like, this is where you're at now. I'm like, oh, yeah, you're right. I can do that. Besides, like, experiencing this and writing about it or, like, presenting at a conference about gender and sexuality or queer theory for teaching mathematics and that kind of thing, you know, I should create a course. Okay. You know, and the course I created was like, basically based on this question I have, like, how could someone who was never, you know, like explicitly taught that things were wrong or that certain things were right, really. I mean, not have been able to figure out for himself, you know, like that fundamental question. Like, so I basically, the question, like in the course description, it's how do people come to understand themselves as and others as gendered and sexual beings? And, you know, how does this happen in different cultures and communities around the world? And what does that mean for what someone could do if they wanted to design experiences? And mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the basic ideas of the course is that it doesn't happen in school very successfully. It probably doesn't happen in families very successfully, or any of the official educational institutions of our society, like family, church, the media, you know, whatever. But, you know, social media is where most people seem these days to learn about gender and sexuality and have access to all sorts of ideas that they might not have otherwise been exposed to as possible for some people in some situations, which could lead them to think about themselves or others in different ways. You know? And that's kind of like the basis of the course. Hmm. So like students come thinking it's going to be about like how to teach sex education, I guess. But we really talk a lot about how just ordinary life experiences are in education.
Okay.
Yeah. So because my background in educational theory is in the field of curriculum studies, which has at its heart this notion that all experiences are a kind of curriculum.
Okay.
So like everyday life is a curriculum. You know, walking down the street, you are exposed to experiences from which you learn, you know, like whatever. So how is that a curriculum, and how could people like sort of interject or help others to reflect on that is sort of part of the course.
Yeah. Okay. So it's about, you're not educating, well, the primary purpose of the course isn't to educate on gender and sexuality, but to teach how to educate, how to become educators in gender and sexuality. But of course, during that process, they're going to learn about gender and sexuality anyway. So
yeah. And yeah. You know, the course does, it can count as part of a women's and gender studies major or minor at the university. Mm-hmm. It was approved for that. The course meets a lot of what we call we don't have a general education, but not to get too bogged down in that. Mm-hmm. It can meet some requirements that people take. Mm-hmm. So students sometimes take it for that purpose. But mostly though, like a lot of students are taking it either because they are majoring or minoring in gender and women's studies, you know, or because they have an interest and they didn't really focus on the education side of it. They just, it just fit into a schedule and they have maybe been questioning things. Early versions of the course that I first taught, like I ran into groups of students that were in that were part of various, you might call them clubs on campus, you know, LGBTQ oriented clubs. And when they heard about this course, they registered because they wanted to make sure it was a, they did it as an action. So like the first time I taught it, it was so great. Like there were students that like for their projects, they would like create a panel of like BDSM people that would then be challenged by them to question their rigidity. In the past, they'd be like, why are you so insistent on like using these ways of understanding yourself and others? Like, they would attack the panel.
Wow.
But what you would have thought was like really exploring things beyond most people's definitions of acceptability, you know, kind of.
And they're pushing their envelopes.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
It was really exciting. I mean, these days, there aren't necessarily students in the course like that, so I have to introduce some of those things. Like, you know, like a few years ago when I taught this course, students brought in these samples of their favorite toys. You know, like I'll have to do that. You know, like because they're not bringing them in themselves.
They don't want to do it. Yeah,
but
interesting.
Yeah, like what do you think it means? Like if someone brings this toy in as like one of their favorite sex toys, if someone sees that and they're talking about it in this way that they're very comfortable with, how is that an education for you? Like, what does that mean for you? What are the possible reactions you could have? What does that reaction mean over time? It could mean anything, right? Depending on who you are and what you were thinking of at the time, right? You know, there's so many different things you can talk about.
That's true. Yep. So
you were saying, yeah, I mentioned like this podcast and this YouTube channel. These are examples of things that some young adult, like, you know, adults who are younger than me, like in their 20s and 30s, are doing, where they're really trying to explicitly create an educational program. And it's available on the internet, so anybody can access it. And so I do share these early on, because students are expecting the course to be about something like, how would you design like a sex education curriculum in a school, say? Like the ones they had were terrible. They'll share all sorts of horror stories, you know. So I did find this podcast and this YouTube channel. They're not like the only ones available. There's like so many things out there, you know. Even something like the podcast, like Dan Savage's podcast. I think that's a really interesting thing to think of. A 12-year-old or a 25-year-old comes across this and starts listening to it, you know. Like, they're going to, like, think about themselves and others in a certain way, right? What way? What do you think are the possible ways, you know? But this one, like, what is sex podcast? Like, it's these two, like, recent college graduates who have tried to go into the business being sex educators for very young children. Like, they're hired by preschools and, you know, elementary schools to come in and create, like, conversations using children's books and children's literature, and at the same time, you know, especially during the pandemic, they came up with the idea of having these conversations with guests each time around a question that a very young child has asked. A question like, what is sex? Or, what is a hairy penis? You know, or, you know, what is gay? You know, like, you know, questions that kids have asked. And they do this podcast, and they have a conversation first about, what do you think might be the questions behind the questions? Like, you know, that this very young child has asked. Like, they might be asking a host of different things by saying this question. And then, you know, what are all the things that we have thought about in our lives and when we were a child that might be related to this question? And they try to come back to, like, well, how should we respond to a child who asks this question? You know? And when I listen to it, it gives me all sorts of things to think about. And so I don't know. I'm wondering, what will my students think of this? You know? And so then I also, like, in the last few years, I thought there's this young person on YouTube that's created this YouTube TV show. I imagine they would have loved to be picked up by some production company, like that sometimes happens with YouTube series, you know, and maybe potentially will have a career in children's television. I don't know, or something else. Yeah. But it's called Queer Kid Stuff, and it's a whole like TV show, and they persist in posting these things, even with a lot of hate mail and stuff. And, and they're short little, like, mini TV shows on YouTube, you know. And, again, it's like an example of someone trying to think about how you might talk to young children. And I think, for me, it's like, I never had anyone talking to me as a young child about anything like this. And when I was in preschool, I can remember, like, climbing a jungle gym thing. I can remember Itsy Bitsy Spider with hand movements and dance movement. I remember I'm a Little Teapot, short and stout games, you know. That's about all I remember, you know. In kindergarten, I remember like things like finger painting, and I remember a bunch of kids like screaming and yelling, and then the teacher choosing me to go stand behind the door because I didn't stop talking when everyone else did or something. I don't know. You know, like, that's about all I remember. I don't remember a discussion of, like, what is sex, you know? I don't remember even having a book read to me in kindergarten.
Yeah. So, no, that's really cool. Yeah. And I'll share those links too, for sure, because those both look pretty amazing.
So I, of course, I have a whole syllabus of similar kinds of things, you know, that people can look to and say, is that something I think I would like to actually promote or not? Like, that's that conversation for me. Like, is this good?
Yeah.
Are parts of it good? Are parts of it bad or dangerous or wrong, do you think? You know, like, you know, that's kind of like,
you know what, if you were to share that with me, I would put it along with this, because, yeah, you know, it's, again, it's a tapestry. There's so many variations, so many different ways, and certain things are going to connect with some people that are not going to connect with others, while something else will connect with them. So it's, I definitely don't have a problem about giving people things to explore and check to help understand themselves or their neighbor who they just don't understand why they're like that. You know, it's helpful.
So yeah, I'm a professor at a university. So I have like a curator of these resources.
Sure.
Like, there was a John Oliver Last Week Tonight episode about sex education a year or two ago. He was like, well, as the school year starts, the parents are going to start complaining about sex education again, you know, and at the end of it, there's like this like 3-minute celebrities talking about sex. Mm-hmm. He's like, isn't that basically what we should show kids? It's like the message of this program, you know, like, and I think, and like, I like to show my students that, you know,
that's cool.
I show them there's like, there's this whole like curriculum in Norway about you're going through adolescence and your body's changing and what could that mean? And they like very explicitly talk in a kind of sex positive way that doesn't recommend or discourage anything, you know,
talks about the facts.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, here's a picture of like a woman's vagina. Like, instead of talking about it in an abstract way, like, this is one, you know, mm-hmm. like, so you can see it, you know, not to be embarrassed by this, you know, like, they actually have a video of a vagina, you know, like a penis, you know, like mm-hmm. and my students are like amazed or astounded, like, you know, like, and it's on YouTube too. So like, that means like anybody in the United States can see it, you know, like,
wow.
And it's not just one video, there's like 20 of them or something.
Wow. It's a whole learn. Well, if there's something you want to learn about, it's on the internet. Yeah. Not all of it's right, but it sounds like this is pretty spot on. So yeah, definitely.
My always question is like, what if I had had access to this? Would I have thought about things differently, or would it still not have been enough because social like assumptions are still so strong in my community? And I wonder, you know, I really wonder. And there's some like these people that try to get, you know, they do these mini lectures and they're like, you can support more of these on Patreon, you know, about like queer coding in films and TV and, you know, all this stuff. And they like, if you come across this and then you're like, what is that film? Maybe I'll go watch it on Netflix, you know? And it's like, whoa. There are people thinking about life this way. Like, what if that was what people had growing up?
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Cool.
Or like a commercial for Honey where it's like three bear guys, you know, who are cooking together in their kitchen, you know, and they're using this brand of honey, but they're also clearly making jokes about their like, about being three bears in bed together every night because they're in a threesome. And it's like a common commercial in the UK. So like,
Wow. Well, that's, I guess when you've collected all these resources, you get some really cool ones. So, is there anything else, you wanted to touch base on, or I know we've hit a lot already.
I mean, what were your questions or your themes that you wanted to cover in this discussion? I don't know if we got
really
away from myself and my thinking, but you can see that like my experience has permeated my professional life and my personal life in all sorts of ways.
That's exactly it. That's exactly what I like to go through. So it's perfect. So yeah, there's a lot there. And
So yeah, I'm less involved. I mean, I used to be more involved in these support groups. And given that I'm trying to balance two relationships, it's really hard for me to go to a meeting, even on Zoom, which would seem to be so convenient, and I have the technology. You know, but like if it's at like 6:30 or 7 at night or whatever, and I'm with one or the other of my partners now, so dinner with them is like heightened in its importance. I can't be away from, so it's hard. My social life has really been narrowed by this challenge of two relationships, I guess.
Yeah.
I used to also be more involved in various like sort of queer community things. Like I was on the art gallery committee for the LGBTQ center. And I still am very active on a Facebook messenger list related to that around queer arts. I'm not really involved in that committee anymore. I was really working with these like queer teenager groups, like one that was like tutoring called Q-Spot. It was also like a support place for queer youth. And another one called Out for STEM, which was sponsored by hospitals and a museum that like encouraged queer youth to consider a future career in STEM-related fields, science, technology, engineering, mathematics. But I kind of dropped off of that, especially with the pandemic and the lack of like meetings. I'm sure that's still happening in some way. But they used to have these like fellows every year that would like create tours of the museum and go and do like various experiences at the hospitals and stuff, and all that has probably been put on hold. And you know. But like a lot of that stuff isn't happening in my life anymore, and I'm more disconnected from a larger sort of sense of what what's his name, that guy Joe Court wrote about in a book about social affirmation that could be really important. Yeah, so like a lot of guys that are like questioning their sexuality or coming out to themselves, they don't necessarily have to end their marriages to women or change their lifestyle, but they might add forms of social affirmation, like join a queer bowling league or like gay rugby or something.
Right.
Yeah, and that would be what they need to like feel like who they are. A lot of that's gone for me, and it's all. I still participate in the Husbands Out for Wives pretty a lot. I think that's more asynchronous and not time dependent. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I think all of it kind of goes in waves. You kind of, you know, when you first have something you're dealing with, you tend to make it. It consumes a lot of your time and bandwidth, and then over time it fades, and then maybe comes back later. You know, we only have so much we can do with our time and energy. So I can see how bouncing between two different homes and stuff could be, take a lot of that.
I mean, like this conversation feels to me like it's some of that. Like we know each other from a support group. Participating in this and supporting your project feels like more than just knowing you in that group. It's like a form of friendship, you know, that I really value. Yeah. And it's like solidifying that kind of relationship. So I think, and there's a few other men from that group that I might text with or have like a private conversation with occasionally that, you know, that is important. So that's still happening too. Well, the regular like meetings or social events are, well, like part of it is pandemic related, but even before the virus, I was really unable to like be as involved in those things. But I also did a lot of those things hoping I might meet somebody.
Right.
It was like selfish reasons. And then you met someone.
And then you met someone completely outside of it.
Yeah.
Life has a way of doing that, but yeah. And you know, there's, you know, various forms of intimacy, and not all of them are romantic or physical. Right. A lot of them are just deep friendships that you can form, and you know, and yeah. Yep. I don't know anything else really to say about that. So, yeah. Hey, thanks, Peter, a lot for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate your doing this for the world.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Yeah, and I guess I look forward to the next check-in. I don't know, some years from now, right?
Another interview on another podcast in four more years. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like that, you know, that series 7 Up, the documentaries in Britain. They started out when the kids were 7 years old. And then 7 years later, like, okay, they had money. And they were like, okay, we'll do it again. And then they kept doing it. Now those people are what, like in their 70s or 80s or something?
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah. I haven't heard of that one. Interesting.
Yeah, it's compelling.
I may have to check.
As they got older, more and more of them didn't want to participate anymore.
I can see that too. You're back again?
Well, it really affected their lives.
Sure.
Like there was, you know,
it's that reality TV kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Yep. Cool. Well, thanks again, Peter. I really appreciate it. Thanks for joining us today. If you haven't yet, be sure to subscribe so you don't miss the next episode. You can listen or subscribe on the human-tapestry.com website, on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, or your favorite podcast place. Be sure to leave us a review, too, and maybe share the podcast with a friend or 200. The Human Tapestry Podcast is all about starting a conversation, so get in touch with me. You can contact me at the website, human-tapestry.com, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Human Tapestry, or on Tumblr at Human Tapestry Podcast. We'll talk next week.